Star Walker Studios presents Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. Hello, fellow gamer. Welcome to episode 151 of Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. I'm Lex Starwalker. On this show, we discuss the craft and art of game mastering. Not only do I pass along any knowledge I've gained over 25 plus years of running RPGs, I also share wisdom from guest GMs and listener GMs like you. This week, I begin an in-depth exploration of the Dungeon Master's Guide. I spend some time discussing the different aspects of a role-playing game and how you can engage players who enjoy those different aspects. So join me on the journey. Together, we can become game masters truly worthy of the title. So I'm really excited to finally be digging into the DMG. I've been looking forward to this for quite a while since the beginning of season 8, actually. So I'm really excited to talk about the DMG. And today I'm just going to spend some time with the introduction of the book. Really just one page of the introduction, talking about the different aspects of the game and how to engage players who particularly enjoy those various aspects. I think it's a really important thing to think about as a dungeon master to maximize the enjoyment of your players and maximize their buy-in into your game and your campaign. I want to send a huge shout out and a thank you to a couple new patrons of Starwalker Studios, Joseph Del Vecchio and Jesse Ware. Thank you very much for becoming patrons of Starwalker Studios. I really appreciate it. Could not do this without the patrons. And thank you to all the patrons for supporting the show. Thank you. Also want to let you know that my D&D 5th edition adventure, The Trickster's Labyrinth, is here. It's out. It's available. It's on the website. You can go find it at starwalkerstudios.com/tricky. And it is an adventure for third level player characters, I should say, and will probably take around 3 to 5 4-hour sessions to get through. Really depends on how much time your players spend with it, whether they explore everything or just try to get to the end as fast as they can. Could take longer, could take less. Who knows? Depends on your group. Should take the PCs from level 3 to level 5. And it's made for a group of 4 to 5 characters, but I have advice in there on how to make it work for smaller groups or larger groups. It works great as just a standalone adventure all by itself. Works great as what I call a segue adventure, an adventure to put between two other adventures and to get the player characters from adventure 1 to adventure 3. Also works great as an adventure to use if you want to get your player characters from one part of your world to another part of the world, or from one world to another, or from one plane to another. Works great for all those things. This adventure works equally well whether you're using any of the published settings or your own homebrew setting. Doesn't matter. It works with anything. It's also, I think, a good adventure for newer GMs. I spent some time in the adventure giving some advice on how to actually run the adventure. A lot of the adventures I've seen, they don't really give you much as far as how to actually do this thing. So I try to give tips and pointers on how to run the adventure. I give thoughts on, you know, how to use this as a segue adventure, you know, how to use it in a campaign you've already got going. If you want to begin a new campaign with it or run it as a one-shot, I give thoughts on creating new third-level characters and how I would go about that. And I just give tips and pointers on running the adventure itself. For instance, I have random encounters in there, and I talk about how to use random encounters, when to use random encounters, why to use random encounters, when you should just have a random encounter and have it not be random at all, and all that good stuff. And, you know, I thought that would be a good idea. You know, we talk a lot on the show about GMing. I get a lot of questions from new GMs or newer GMs So I was thinking about you guys when I was writing this thing and trying to address any questions that new GMs might have or less experienced GMs. So again, you can check that out at my website, starwalkerstudios.com. I have a link to it in the show notes. And I've had quite a few people get it already. And I'm really looking forward to hearing from people who've read it. And even more looking forward to hearing from people who've run it and or played it, what people think about it. Also, I was just on Nerdarchy this week. I was really happy to be on Nerdarchy. I'm a longtime fan of their YouTube channel. And talked with Nerdarchist Dave about the Trickster's Labyrinth, as well as other RPG topics and GMing and D&D and all that good stuff. So I'll have that linked in the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com if you want to check that out. And if you haven't checked out Nerdarchy, definitely check them out. They've got just oodles of content, great content. They have actual plays that they do, as well as a lot of produced videos about RPGs and being a GM and being a player and D&D and other games and all kinds of stuff. Lots of great stuff. Go check them out. So as far as the Trickster's Labyrinth, I am planning to talk about it more in a future episode. I've had some questions from listeners regarding it, specifically, you know, how I did it and questions about the creation process. And, you know, obviously not everybody is going to try to self-publish an adventure, but most, if not all GMs, at least at some point, design their own adventure to run for their group. So people are interested in how I did it and all that good stuff. So I would love to hear from you if you have a question about the adventure or the process of creating it or publishing it or anything like that. I'd love to hear from you. Like I said, we'll do an episode in the future where I'll field all those questions and we'll talk about it. So I've already started a thread on our community and I've already had some people ask questions. So I'll have a link to that in the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com. If you have a question or just a topic you'd like me to cover in regards to the Trickster's Labyrinth, creating adventures, things like that, definitely let me know. I'd love to hear from you. All right, well, that's it for all of my beginning of the show good stuff, and let's get on to our main topic, and let's crack open that DMG. Today, I am going to start a new series on the show in which I am going to pore over the Dungeon Master's Guide. This is a fantastic resource, not only for GMs running the latest incarnation of D&D, but for just GMs everywhere for any game. There are a lot of great ideas in here. There are a lot of great tools in here, and it's awesome. I'm a big fan of this Dungeon Master's Guide. I've been reading Dungeon Master's Guide since AD&D First Edition, and this is definitely my favorite incarnation of the DMG yet, and I'm really pleased with what Wizards did with this book. So I recently did a whole series of episodes where I went through the Player's Handbook. I did not address every chapter of the Player's Handbook. Instead, I hit what I considered the highlights for GMs, mainly the rules and mechanics. We skipped talking about each and every spell. We skipped talking about each and every character class. Instead, we focus more on the general rules of the game, just so that we could all have a nice firm foundation of understanding so that we could start really getting under the hood of D&D here with the Dungeon Master's Guide. So with the Player's Handbook, I tried very hard to cover a chapter in an episode of the show, but with the DMG, we're going to take our time, and it may take multiple episodes to get through a single chapter, just depending on what a given chapter covers. I'm not so much concerned with how long it takes us to get through this, and I'm not going to do this every single episode. We'll have other topics that we discuss as well. So I'm not in any big hurry to get through the Dungeon Master's Guide, and I'd rather take our time and really make sure that we say everything that needs to be said or that we can say about a given section or topic. So if you have a copy of the Dungeon Master's Guide, you may want to follow along with me as I start going through this, but I don't think that that's required. You know, you do you. whatever works for you. So we'll crack it open here. Now, I do have a first printing of the DMG, and this is a point maybe I should have made when I talked about the player's handbook. So if you have a later printing, there might be some minor differences between the version you're using and the version I'm using. And if so, you know, your version is the better one because I have first printing. And unfortunately, my DMG is starting to fall apart. The binding is starting to fall apart. So sometime in the near future, I'm probably going to be using Wizard's awesome product replacement policy to get an updated DMG. But I'm going to really wait until pages are literally falling out before I do that because, you know, I like my DMG that I have. It has sentimental value. So all of Wizard's books, I don't know if you've noticed this, but all of their books for 5th edition have a funny little disclaimer in the beginning of the book on the credits page. So our disclaimer for the DMG says, Wizards of the Coast does not officially endorse the following tactics, which are guaranteed to maximize your enjoyment as a dungeon master. First, always keep a straight face and say okay, no matter how ludicrous or doomed the player's plan of action is. Second, no matter what happens, pretend that you intended all along for everything to unfold the way it did. That's a really good thing to keep in mind. That's something I need to work on personally. No matter what happens at your table, act like that's completely what you planned on happening. Don't let the players think for a minute that they've surprised you. Third, if you're not sure what to do next, feign illness, end the session early, and plot your next move. I've actually never done that. There's times I probably should have done that, but I've never done that. When all else fails, roll a bunch of dice behind your screen, study them for a moment with a look of deep concern mixed with regret, let loose a heavy sigh, and announce that Tiamat swoops from the sky and attacks. Now that I have done, only for me it wasn't Tiamat, it was a group of red dragons. But I've done that exact thing long, long ago in my days running 2nd edition. So that's the disclaimer. So now we have the introduction, and this page, the first page of the introduction, is probably going to be one of the first pages that falls out of my book. It's on its way out. And really cool piece of art here on page 5. And I've got to say real quick, I've poo-pooed 5th edition's art once or twice on the show, I think. And I just wish that they could get the artists that they have for Magic the Gathering, especially, you know, some of the sets are better than others, but Magic tends to have phenomenal art, D&D less so. However, I do want to say when I have poo-pooed the art in D&D, a lot of times when I'm being critical of the art, I'm referring to the art in the Monster Manual. I think a lot of the art in the DMG especially, and also, you know, quite a bit of the art in the Player's Handbook is actually pretty good. The Monster Manual, though, is pretty bad. A lot of that art is pretty bad, which is unfortunate because I don't think I've ever shown my players at the table a picture from the DMG or the Player's Handbook. To me, those are more to inspire me as I'm, you know, using the books. They're not so much something I'm going to use at the table. But on the other hand, the illustrations in the Monster Manual at least should be art that you're using at the table. I tend not to because more often than not, the illustration of a monster in the Monster Manual is ranking from not very good to downright terrible, making things that should be scary instead comical and not in a good way. So that's unfortunate. So I just wanted to say that. I don't think I've ever made that distinction before, but usually when I'm criticizing the art, I'm referring to the Monster Manual. So like this piece here on page 5 of the DMG, I rather like. So in the introduction, we have a bunch of wasted space here. This is a thing in every introduction of every RPG book, it seems like to me, where we have to waste a few pages telling you what's in the book, as if the table of contents didn't already do that, explaining to you what a book is, what an RPG is, what a role-playing game is, what a dungeon master is. I guess, you know, there's people out there that need these things explained to them, especially if you're a brand new player or brand new DM. But for someone like me, for a lot of us, this is wasted space. And, you know, it's one thing. It's fine to tell me what a dungeon master is. Maybe I don't know. But the like how to use this book, you open it and you read it. You use the table of contents, the index, chapter and section headings to find information you want to read about and then read said information. Do we really need a few pages explaining this to us and telling us what the different sections are and how we, quote, use them? I mean, come on. So yeah, we'll skip this. Nothing more to say about that. However, a lot of times, introduction is just wasted pages in a book, especially in RPG, and you can safely just completely skip it and wish that they would have used those pages for something else. However, in the DMG, there is one page of the introduction that at least has some arguable value, and that is page 6, where it talks about knowing your players. So this is something that if you've DM'd or GM'd much at all, or even just played RPGs much at all, is probably explaining the glaringly obvious to you. But again, for someone who's completely new to the hobby or someone who just hasn't paid attention, Wizards proceeds to explain some of the different things that players might enjoy about the game. And this can be important to you as a DM just to understand kind of where each player at your table is coming from and what they enjoy about the game, and making sure that you at the very least highlight aspects of the game that your particular players really enjoy and maybe downplaying aspects of the game that they don't enjoy. Now, I actually like this approach as opposed to some other approaches I've seen in other games where they try to pigeonhole players into archetypes or try to define archetypes of, you know, this player is a munchkin or that player is a storyteller or whatever. I don't think anyone really believes that any one player really neatly falls into one of those archetypes. I mean, they're more useful as a theoretical concept to try to understand some player behaviors and player outlooks. But, you know, it's when you use something like that, like right out of the box, you know, this doesn't really apply to real life. One has to question the usefulness or value of that. So I like this approach better, where instead of trying to come up with player archetypes that don't actually exist in the real world, or at least there aren't people that are specifically that archetype, instead this focuses on different aspects of the game or different activities in the game that different players will enjoy or not enjoy to a greater or lesser degree. And I think that's a much better way to approach it as someone writing an RPG book and also as a game master. You know, don't waste your time trying to psychoanalyze your players and decide what type of player they are. What's much more time effective, I think, and much more to the point is to think about the different aspects of the game that you're playing and the different things that can be done in that game and the different ways that that game can be played, and figure out where your players are as far as which of those things they really enjoy, which of those things they don't enjoy. So these are just a few possibilities. Even with D&D, we could probably have a discussion and come up with other aspects of the game that aren't covered here, but this is hitting the main highlights. So first we have acting. So part of a lot of our experience of an RPG is acting. Players who enjoy acting like getting into character and speaking in their characters' voices. Role players at heart, they enjoy social interactions with NPCs, monsters, and their fellow party members. So this is really helpful, right? This is telling you what we mean by acting, what aspect of the game we're talking about, and what a player who enjoys acting might look like. Now we talk about, okay, you have a player who enjoys acting. Here are some tips on how to engage that player in the game, how to keep them interested, how to keep them invested in what's going on, and how to help them have a good time. So if you have players that enjoy acting, here are some ideas. You can engage them by giving them opportunities to develop their characters' personalities and backgrounds. You can engage them by allowing them to interact regularly with NPCs. And you can also engage them by adding role-playing elements to combat encounters. And finally, by incorporating elements from their characters' backgrounds into your adventures. So chances are good at your given table with your given players, you've got at least one player that enjoys the acting element of the game. And if that's the case, those are some great ideas on how you can keep that player interested. So these are all really great tips for acting and for players who enjoy acting. And, you know, something that definitely came to my mind reading through these is it seems like a great place for these players who enjoy this is in a city. You know, because it talks about, you know, giving them the ability to interact regularly with NPCs, giving them opportunities to develop their characters, personalities, and backgrounds. And a great place to do those things is in the city because you have so many NPCs to choose from and you can open it up to the players to where they want to go, what kind of NPCs they want to interact with. So maybe they want to hang out in the tavern and interact with the NPCs in the tavern, or maybe they want to go to a sage or a library or a university and interact with the sages of your world who know things about the world. Or maybe they want to go find members of the Thieves Guild and interact with them. So that's a great thing about a city is there are so many possibilities, especially if you're comfortable approaching it from a more kind of sandbox perspective where the players really have the freedom to interact with anyone they want, to go to any part of the city that they want. And a great way to handle that is to let the players know ahead of time, whether it's before the campaign starts or at the end of the previous session, say, hey, next week we're going to be in the city and literally the sky's the limit. Let me know, you know, what you might want to do, where you might want to go, you know, so that I can have some good NPCs ready. So if you want to go to the library, I'll have some NPCs at the library. If you want to go to one of the temples, I can work on that, you know. And I think sometimes GMs are hesitant to kind of show their hand or to ask for that kind of thing from players, but I don't think there's anything wrong with it. And I think your players will appreciate it because you're going to be better prepared. And it's going to be a lot more enjoyable for them if they decide to go to the temple, for instance, and you've already got some really cool NPCs worked out for them to interact with. Then it would be if they just decide to go to the temple, you didn't see that coming, and you just have to come up with NPCs on the fly. I think any one of us is going to be able to come up with far better NPCs with some time to do it ahead of time than we would be able to on the fly during play. So don't be afraid to ask your players, especially at the end of a session, it's a great time to do it. Hey, what do you guys plan to do next week? You know, what's on your agenda or what NPCs would you like to talk to? And then you can use that to develop those NPCs more. And I think especially players who enjoy the acting side of the game will really appreciate that. Next, we have exploring. Players who desire exploration want to experience the wonders that a fantasy world has to offer. They want to know what's around the next corner or hill. They also like to find hidden clues and treasure. Engage players who like exploration by dropping clues that hint at things yet to come, by letting them find things when they take the time to explore, by providing rich descriptions of exciting environments and using interesting maps and props, and by giving monsters secrets to uncover or cultural details to learn. Yeah, these are really great ideas for exploring. And, you know, something that comes to mind to me looking at these is, you know, this is really well suited with a more sandbox style of adventure, which is not to say that your entire adventure or campaign has to be a sandbox, but just in saying that you're okay with the players just deciding to go check something out, you know, whether they have a map and they decide we want to go see what that thing on the map is, or they hear a rumor, you know, from someone in town and they decide they want to check that out. You know, that's really going to appeal to players who like exploring. And, you know, it's definitely something to be mindful of if you're a newer GM to realize that that can happen. You might just throw out something on the fly, you know, maybe they're interacting with an NPC in town and you just, you know, on a whim, you mention you know, a spirit that haunts a hill or something like that. And you don't have any ideas about that. You literally, it just popped in your head and you said it. But now suddenly the players want to go check that out. So that can happen. And it's funny. It's a Murphy's Law kind of thing, it seems like, where it seems like the thing that you just come up with on the fly that you have no idea what it is, that's the thing the players are going to get interested in, not the thing that you've completely fleshed out and you know all about it. I don't know why that is, but it seems to go that way a lot. So, you know, as you get more experience running games, you can become more and more comfortable with handling those situations and just winging it. You know, it's like, I have no idea what the haunting on the hill is, but now I got to come up with something because the players want to go there. And allowing your players to do that instead of trying to steer them back toward what you're prepared for. And the more that you can do that, or at least the more that you can let players explore things that they're interested in, the more you're going to be able to scratch that itch for the players that like exploring. I think a great way to kind of hedge your bet here, if you're not comfortable improvising so much, is give them a few interesting hooks that you have figured out or you have thought about. So, you know, instead of just off the top of your head coming up with the haunted hill, come up with maybe two or three or four or five interesting rumors or interesting things going on that the players might hear about, and kind of flesh all of those out. You know, maybe not entirely. You don't want to waste a bunch of time on it in case they don't bite, but have some ideas. So if they decide, oh yeah, we want to check that thing out, you have some idea where to go with it. And as your campaign goes on, you can kind of just little by little, like maybe every week you come up with something new, and slowly over time you build up this repertoire of all these rumors or these interesting sites that they've heard about. And all of them you've got some ideas for and you fleshed out to some degree, so that when they decide, hey, let's check out that interesting thing we heard about a few weeks ago, you can just run with it. And as time goes on, maybe you get to the point where you're like, okay, I have plenty of things on my list of things I've mentioned to the players. I don't need to really put more little hooks in front of them. So now I can spend my free time fleshing those out more in case they or another group in the future decide to investigate that. And I'm of the firm belief that, you know, if you're smart about the way you do your prep and the way you use your prep, really very little, if any, of your prep time is ever wasted. So maybe you come up with a hook of the haunted hill. And over time, as the players continue to not investigate that, you kind of flesh that out more and more in the background in case they ever do. Well, maybe they never go after it. Well, then, you know, once you've got this thing really fleshed out and you think it's awesome, you can figure out a more direct way to steer them there. And then that hook that you planted way back when that they never really bit on, that is now foreshadowing that you did way back when, because they're like, oh yeah, we heard about this place months ago and we never checked it out. Now we have a really good reason to check it out. Why did they have a really good reason to check it out? Because you finished the thing and you really want them to go there now. So you came up with an even more irresistible hook than just a random rumor to get them over on that hill so that they can see the cool stuff you came up with. Or another way you could approach it is maybe you just save that for a later campaign and you'll run an adventure there. Maybe you'll start the adventure there. So, you know, I don't think that when it comes to GMing, I don't think it's an either or thing when it comes to planning and preparing versus improvising. A good GM does both. And, you know, sometimes people get this dichotomy in their head of, oh, I either improvise everything or I plan everything. And sometimes, you know, the people that are against the planning will tell you that, oh, you know, you waste all this time planning things that you never use. And I don't think that's really true. I think if you're creative and you're always keeping your eye open for opportunities, and if you run over an extended period of time, you know, I look at this from someone who's always running games forever, because that's kind of how I am, then you eventually use everything. Time is never wasted.
This is Matthew Colville, and you're listening to Game Master's Journey.
I want to give a quick shout out to the patrons of Starwalker Studios. The support of the patrons makes this show possible.
If you enjoy Game Master's Journey and you'd like to give a little back, becoming a patron is a great way to do so. Patrons get some cool perks like game material I make for Primordia and access to a special monthly podcast I produce just for the patrons. I'd also like to give a huge shout out and thank you to my Tier 4 patron, Mr. Steve Strickland. Let's hear it for Steve.
Yeah.
Yes.
You the man.
You the man.
Thank you so much, Steve, and thank you to all the patrons. You can find out more about becoming a patron by clicking on the Patreon button at the top of the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com. Next, we have instigating. This is another aspect of the game or another activity in the game that players can enjoy. Players who like to instigate action are eager to make things happen, even if that means taking perilous risks. They would rather rush headlong into danger and face the consequences than face boredom. I've definitely had players who like instigating at my table. I can sometimes be that player if things really start dragging on too long. So if you have a player or players who enjoy instigating, here are ways to engage them. Allow them to affect their surroundings. Include things in your adventures to tempt them. Let their actions put the characters in a tight spot. Include encounters with NPCs who are as feisty and unpredictable as they are. Now, one thing that I like here in these instigating examples is letting their actions put the characters in a tight spot. You know, another way I would say this is letting them realize the consequences of their actions. Right. And, you know, a lot of times what will happen with someone who likes instigating or maybe just someone who resorts to instigating when they start getting bored is a lot of times they'll end up doing something rash. And it can be a lot of fun when that happens to let there be consequences for that and let the group as a whole have to struggle with those consequences. Next, we have fighting. It's a pretty big part of the game, and you're definitely probably going to have at least some players who really enjoy fighting. They like kicking the tar out of villains and monsters, and they look for any excuse to start a fight, favoring bold action over careful deliberation. So you can kind of see here the fighting goes well with the instigating. But, you know, just because you're instigating doesn't mean you're fighting, right? So there are two separate things. So some ways to engage players who like fighting are springing unexpected combat encounters on them, vividly describing the havoc their characters wreak with their attacks and spells, including combat encounters with large numbers of weak monsters, and interrupting social interaction and exploration with combat. I think you'll kind of see as we go through these different aspects of the game how they all kind of reinforce each other. And how you can, with any given element of the game, you can actually be serving multiple of these aspects at the same time. So for instance, fighting, you know, keeping your combats interesting and varied and unique and different, not only will keep your players who really dig the fighting part of the game engaged, but it's also going to help keep the players who like the storytelling and the problem solving and the exploring aspects of the game engaged as well. Because you're pulling those elements into the combat and it's not just beating on a bag of hit points. Next, we have optimizing. So this is an activity that some or even many players enjoy. Players who enjoy optimizing their characters' capabilities like to fine-tune their characters for peak combat performance by gaining levels, new features, and magic items. They welcome any opportunity to demonstrate their character's superiority. So here are some ways that you can engage those players. Ensure steady access to new abilities and spells. Use desired magic items as adventure hooks. Include encounters that let their characters shine. And provide quantifiable rewards like experience points for non-combat encounters. Another activity that players like is problem solving. Players who want to solve problems like to scrutinize NPC motivations, untangle a villain's machinations, solve puzzles, and come up with plans. Engage players who like to solve problems by including encounters that emphasize problem solving, by rewarding planning and tactics with in-game benefits, by occasionally allowing a smart plan to grant an easy win for the players, and by creating NPCs with complex motives.
Yeah, one of these under problem solving I really like, which is occasionally allowing a smart plan to grant an easy win for the players. And this is really important because I think a lot of us as GMs, I know this is true for me, we like to challenge our players, right? We not only like to challenge the characters, but we like to challenge the players. And we feel like if it's too easy, it won't be fun. And I think to a large degree, that's true. And I think as a general rule, you want your game to be challenging. You know, for instance, combat, if every time there's a combat, it's just a cakewalk, it's a face roll, there's no real danger of the characters dying or even getting hurt. There's no real challenge. They just, you know, steamroll through it. It's going to be really boring. And those combats are going to be really boring. The players aren't going to enjoy them. It's not going to be fun. You know, we need some challenge to really enjoy the game side of the role-playing game. So I think as a general rule, that's definitely true. However, that doesn't mean that every single encounter or every single combat or every single social interaction has to be challenging. I think that you want your game overall, in general, to be challenging. But especially, you know, what it's talking about here with the problem solving, you know, like say you have your PCs are going to assault a keep. And they spend literal in real world time hours planning this assault. Maybe they come up with something really clever and that you honestly don't think that the people manning the keep have thought of. They think of an avenue of attack or a way of assaulting this keep that the people in the keep have never even thought of before. And you're sitting there thinking, oh my gosh, like, if I play this quote fairly, if I just role play the NPCs, you know, fairly, the PCs are just going to steamroll them because they're not going to see this coming. They haven't planned for this contingency and it's going to be easy. It's, you know, it's almost a guaranteed victory and it's not going to be challenging at all. You know, I think a lot of times, a lot of us would be inclined to quote, fix it so that it is challenging, come up with some reason that the player's plan doesn't work or come up with some way that the NPCs planned ahead for something like this happening. And, you know, if your players are constantly coming up with these harebrained ideas that, you know, lead to these situations where it's just a cakewalk, you know, yeah, then you run into the problem of the game's not challenging, it's too easy, the characters and the players aren't getting challenged and they get bored. But if it's a one-time thing or a once-in-a-blue-moon thing where they just come up with this fantastic plan, let it work. Let it work amazingly well. Let it be, you know, let the what you thought was going to be this epic pitched battle to take this keep, let it be easy. Let it go, you know, just a few dice rolls and it's over, you know, if that's the way it needs to be. You know, let the players have that win and let them see that, hey, if we really think about what we're doing and if we really take the time to plan, we can circumvent difficulties. And just like in the real world, you know, we can work smarter instead of work harder. And I think it will just increase the immersion of your game. And, you know, I mentioned harebrained schemes that players come up with. You know, there's a definite difference between players coming up with a truly brilliant, cunning, feasible plan that you think for whatever reason the NPCs would not have thought of, would not have planned against. There's a big difference between that and the players coming up with something ridiculous and you just letting it work because it's what the players came up with. Those are two very different things, you know. And I think if your players come up with an awesome plan that you think is solid, and even beyond that, you think it's something that the NPCs wouldn't have thought of or planned for, I think you should give them the win. I think you should let it be easy, you know, because it's going to be awesome because the players are going to get to see this really cool plan that they came up with work. But on the other side of the coin, if the players come up with a ridiculous plan or a stupid plan or a plan with glaring holes in it, then it should blow up in their face. You know, you should be fair. And that means that sometimes the players get an easy win when they really thought things through. And that means that sometimes things go against them when they do something stupid or they make a plan based on faulty information or whatever. You know, I know there are some GMs out there that will just let whatever stupid thing the players come up with work. And I can tell you, I've played in groups like that before, and it might be fun for a while. And some of your players might consistently enjoy it and it never gets old. But for some of us, at least, or a lot of us, that isn't fun. That's not even playing a game anymore. If just any stupid thing you come up with is going to work. So there's a difference. And I think you can see the difference. And finally, the last aspect of the game that they discuss here is storytelling. Players who love storytelling want to contribute to a narrative. They like it when their characters are heavily invested in an unfolding story, and they enjoy encounters that are tied to and expand an overarching plot. In order to engage players who like storytelling, use their characters' backgrounds to help shape the stories of the campaign. Make sure an encounter advances the story in some way. Make their characters' actions help steer future events. And give NPCs ideals, bonds, and flaws that the adventurers can exploit. Yeah, these are great tips for the storytelling. And the only thing that I'll add is that, you know, storytelling doesn't have to mean linear. It doesn't have to mean that every encounter or every scene or even nearly or most encounters or scenes have to tie into the, quote, main story. Even if there's something happening that has nothing to do with whatever your main story is or even a subplot or anything like that, it can still be storytelling and it can still access that part of the game. You know, storytelling really just means character development and things that make sense, right? So if your players' characters are interacting with the world and they're interacting with NPCs and things are logically coherent and internally consistent and things make sense and they're exploring the world, which again is another aspect of the game, exploration, that's going to scratch the storytelling itch. It doesn't have to feed into your, quote, main plot, whatever that is. And I think sometimes, you know, we get a little fixated on that when we think about storytelling and we think that it means that everything has to tie into the main plot somehow. And it's not true, because if you actually do that, it gets feeling really contrived and artificial, and it breaks immersion. It breaks verisimilitude. So it's totally fine to have random things happen that have nothing to do with anything. And as long as you're letting the players interact with well-developed NPCs and you're letting them experience a well-realized world, even if it's just a random thing and doesn't really have anything to do with any of the, quote, quests that they're on, it's still storytelling and they'll still enjoy it. So there you go. There are 7 aspects of the game, 7 different activities in the game that different players are going to enjoy, and some ideas on how you can engage players that enjoy those different activities. And I think with all of these, you can really use these ideas as a launching point. I mean, you could easily come up with even more ideas to engage a player that likes acting or exploring or instigating or fighting or optimizing or problem solving or storytelling. And I think you'll see, or you saw as we went through this, that any given player that you think of more likely than not enjoys multiple of these activities, numerous of them, maybe even all of them to some degree or another, right? Like me personally, I enjoy every one of these activities. Now, some I enjoy more than others, but I enjoy all of them to some degree. So again, that's why I think that this is a more useful way to approach this concept of kind of tailoring the way you run your game to meet your players where they're at and provide an experience that they're really going to enjoy. I think that this is a slightly more useful way to approach that than trying to define archetypes of players and try to put your players in different archetypes. Because just as any given player is going to enjoy different of these activities and maybe even all of them, like I do, chances are good that you're going to see more than one archetype in any given player. You might, again, see all of them, right?
So I just personally find this more useful and more getting to the point of what is it specifically in the game that's engaging this particular player, and how can I bring more of that into the experience so that they stay interested? Now, one thing I have to point out that's strangely absent in this discussion here in the DMG is discussion on what you as the dungeon master enjoy, right? It's not all about the players. I mean, you're a person too. You're supposed to be having fun too. I guess maybe it's just assumed that the DM is going to look out for number one, and that the DM is going to also realize what she enjoys about the game and is going to make sure that that's a part of the game. Or maybe it's assumed that that's just going to happen naturally. But I have seen GMs get overly focused on making their players happy and making an experience that's what their players want, and forget to run a game that they're going to enjoy running, and then get burnt out because they're not enjoying running the game. So I can definitely understand why Wizards might just assume that you're doing this automatically, but I don't know that we can assume that. And I think it's worth at least pointing out that as a GM, you should be having a good time too. And you should definitely be focusing in on the aspects of play that you enjoy. So for instance, you know, to use these examples, if you're a GM and you really don't like the optimizing aspect of things, I mean, sure, if you have a player that really likes optimizing, you know, throw them a bone every once in a while and you know, let them get their optimizing rocks off. But at the same time, don't feel like you have to be doing that every session or every scene or every encounter, especially if it's going to make the game a drag for you. You know, something else that isn't really discussed here, but I think is also important to consider, is finding synergy. And not just finding synergy between yourself as a GM and the players, as far as what kind of an experience you're looking for, but also finding synergy among the players, right? So if you've got a table full of players who love the acting and the storytelling and the problem solving, and they don't so much care for the fighting or the optimizing or even the instigating, and then you have one player who's all about the fighting and the optimizing and instigating when they get bored, that one player is going to drive the rest of the players crazy, right? Because it's not a good fit. You know, you have four people who like A, and you've got the fifth person who likes B, and there's not a lot of overlap. Now, that's a pretty extreme example. And honestly, in my going on 30 years now of playing RPGs, I don't know that I've ever actually seen that happen, or if it did, I wasn't aware of it. But it's at least a theoretical possibility, right? And, you know, that's a pretty extreme example. And you might not see that extreme of an example, but you might see a lesser version of it where you've got kind of a mismatch between what different players are wanting from the game. And if you have a pretty good spread, or it's pretty even, you know, half the group is more into the optimizing and the fighting, and the other half is more into the acting and the storytelling, then you can probably balance things in such a way that everybody's happy. And every session, you know, it's 50% combat and optimizing stuff and 50% storytelling, and everybody's happy, or everybody's equally unhappy, right? But if it's not an even mix, you know, and maybe you have one person that's out in left field compared to everyone else, then it's going to be hard to keep that one person happy. And times when you are keeping that one person happy, then the other people maybe aren't happy, you know? So that's something to think about. And, you know, it really depends, because we're all in different situations. And I know that there are people out there who, for instance, you know, there's not a lot of people around them who role play, and they found four or five people that they can role play with, and that's it. And they kind of have to play with these people, and that's all there is. Or there are people who have been playing with the same group for a really long time, and they're all really good friends above and beyond playing D&D together. So it's really important to keep this group together, even though, you know, maybe the players aren't really, you know, well suited to one another as far as what they enjoy in the game. So if you're in a situation like that, then you know, you have to try to make it work.
But if you're in a situation where you can kind of pick your players for a given adventure or a given campaign, it's definitely something to think about. And it's a great thing to talk about when you're recruiting players, to talk about, what is this campaign going to be like? Is it going to be a dungeon crawl? Is it going to be a sandbox? Is it going to be a lot of role playing and a lot of acting and not very much combat? Or is it going to be one combat after another? You know, those are good things to understand as a GM. You know, what is this campaign going to be, so that you can tell the players, so that they know what they're getting into and they know if this is a game they're going to enjoy or not. And then if you want to have a dungeon crawl that's just wall-to-wall combat all the time, all the players at the table are excited about that and on board with that, and you don't have a disgruntled player that just wants to talk to NPCs all day, for example. So, you know, again, if you're in a situation where you've just got a certain number of players and that's all you've got, then you want to think more about, you know, making everybody happy and finding compromises and all that good stuff. But if you're in a situation where you're getting ready to run a campaign and you have a pool of players to pull from, then you want to think about being more upfront with the possible players about what exactly you want out of the campaign, what exactly you want from their characters, so that you can get the players that are going to enjoy the type of campaign you want to run. So I think I will wrap up our discussion of the DMG there today, kind of a short segment today, and really just talking about one page in this book about knowing your players. But next is chapter one, A World of Your Own. And we start getting into some great thoughts on world building and planning your campaign and stuff like that. And if I start getting into that now, we're going to have a super long episode, and I try to avoid those. And also, I think we're going to start talking about world building. I mean, that's what the next chunk of the DMG is about. So I'll probably combine that with some actual world building discussion of my D&D homebrew world of Primordia. And I was actually inspired to finally create my own D&D world after so many years of running in my version of the Forgotten Realms because of the DMG and because of its discussion on world building. And it just got me really inspired to build my own world. So, you know, if you, like me, are ready to take the plunge and you want to create your own world to run your D&D games in, check out chapter one of the DMG and start reading there. And the next time we talk about the DMG on the show, we'll be talking all about that and we can compare notes. I hope you enjoy the beginning of what I'm sure will be a lengthy exploration of the DMG. Definitely let me know what you think. I'd love to hear from you. And this is just one of the topics we're going to be talking about in season 9. Also going to be talking about world building, and probably the next DMG episode will also be world building, because the next part of the DMG is about world building. So I'll be getting you up to speed on my world of Primordia and talking about the world building I've been doing. Going to be having some more interviews with other listener GMs, and going to be continuing my series on the roles of the GM. There are a lot more roles to talk about. We GMs, we wear a lot of hats. So those are just some of the interesting things we'll be talking about going on with season 9. If you would like to get a hold of me, please visit the website, starwalkerstudios.com. There you can email me, find my Twitter, Google+, Facebook, Pinterest, YouTube, all that good stuff, as well as the Game Master's Journey voicemail number, where you can leave me a voice message. If your question or feedback is entertaining or enlightening, you might even hear your message on the show. If you have any questions, feedback, or suggestions for future topics, I'd love to hear from you. You can also find a link to the Game Master's Journey community, where you can share ideas with other listener GMs and myself, and just connect with other gamers and say, hi, what's up? What you playing? What you doing? And finally, you can learn about how you can support the show by becoming a patron, by making a one-time donation, or by using my Amazon referral link when you shop on Amazon, or by purchasing my adventure, The Trickster's Labyrinth. You can find all this and more at StarWalkerStudios.com. I hope that you have a chance to play your favorite RPG this week. I hope you have a chance to run your favorite RPG this week. I'll be back soon with another episode of Game Master's Journey. Until then, game on. Getting tricky. Tricky, tricky.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts.
This episode's music, courtesy of Cloudwalker, Transboy, Renfield, Stanko, and Ish. See the show notes for more details at StarWalkerStudios.com/Game Master's Journey.